You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 20th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the programme, Jared Kushner is off to solve the Middle East conflict. What could possibly go wrong? Eager as ever to help, we will have some tips on what a putative peacemaker should and shouldn't do. Then defence in Europe. We'll find out why Bulgaria wants Macedonia to join NATO and also why EU battlegroups may never see active service. We're off then to Georgia for the latest from the most momentous congressional run off election in years. And later in the show, Whitney Wolfe, the founder of Bumble, a dating app in which women make the first move. She'll be discussing the role of feminism in the male-heavy tech world.
Listen, misogyny is alive and well. And, well, let's correct that. It's alive and unwell. But when I say it's alive and thriving, it's because we have a long way to go.
All that plus our regular review of the Asian newspapers, and we're at the opening of a new pavilion at London's Serpentine Gallery. All coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. The United States Air Force has shot down an Iranian-built drone near Tanf in Syria. Officials said the drone was operated by Syrian government forces and was threatening ground troops allied to the US-led coalition combating Islamic State. The incident follows Sunday's shooting down of a Syrian Sukhoi Su-22 by another American aircraft. US authorities also confirmed the death last month of Islamic State's top cleric, Turki al-Binali, in an airstrike. IS have also reported his passing. France's recently installed Minister of Defence, Sylvie Goulard, has resigned after less than a month in office. The former MEP has quit following an investigation into whether her party, MoDem, had misused EU funds to pay party workers. This follows Monday's resignation of Richard Ferrand, the Territorial Cohesion Minister, following allegations of improper behaviour pertaining to a property deal. While both have issued the denials of malfeasance traditional in such circumstances, their resignations are either proof of President Emmanuel Macron's determination to combat sleaze, or confirmation of how big a task that is, or both. Saudi Arabia has escalated pressure on semi-blockaded Gulf Emirate Qatar by deporting all Qatari-owned camels and sheep presently grazing on Saudi pasture land, a practice long tolerated in recognition of the fact that Qatar lacks edible greenery. Qatari officials estimate that 15,000 camels and 10,000 sheep have been repatriated. Emergency provisions of water and fodder are being provided. And 15 men have been arrested in Madhya Pradesh state in India in response to accusations that they cheered on Pakistan during a cricket match between the two countries on Sunday. Pakistan defeated India in the final of the ICC Champions Trophy, the second most important tournament in the second most interesting form of cricket. The men have been charged with sedition. Local police insist that this is not for applauding Pakistan as such, but for anti-Indian imprecations that may have been uttered while they were so doing. And we have also some breaking news tonight. Central Station and the Grand Place in Brussels have been evacuated following reports of an explosion. Police have neutralised a suspect. I'm joined with more on this by Ryan Heath, senior EU correspondent at Politico in Brussels. Ryan, what do we know for sure?
We know for sure that the military police, who have been a permanent presence on the street in Brussels really for about, well, 18 months now since the first Paris attacks, that we have sources saying that they have shot one person and that there was another person who may, we can't really confirm this, may have been attempting to blow himself and others up. There was an explosion. That's what we know for sure inside the central station itself. So I'm down here on the police tape here at the scene, and some pool reporters have just been led into the scene itself. So we're going to know a lot more in a few minutes when we can have some actual footage from inside that scene. So I think, I mean, it's fair to say that life has gone on roughly as normal here in Brussels. There's a small scene that's been contained. There may be terror links to the attack, but it's not like before. It's not where the entire city has been shut down. There aren't deaths, and the situation does appear to be neutralized.
Just to follow that up, though, police are saying there are two suspects, or were two suspects rather than one?
That I haven't heard directly, because I've just been directly here on the scene and checking in on social media where I can. So we haven't had that briefed to us here on the scene. But if you're getting it from other sources, I'm not going to contradict it.
Reports are suggesting that it was Belgian military rather than military police or police that apprehended or neutralised the suspect. Just to explain or to put it into context for non-Belgian listeners, why are the military the first port of call in a situation like this rather than the local police?
So if people recall back in November 2015 after the Paris attacks, that was very quickly traced back to being organised in Brussels. And Brussels was put on a four-day lockdown where all critical infrastructure was shut down for 4 days. The only people who could enforce that shutdown were members of the military. There weren't enough police or enough specialist armed police to conduct that operation. And so many of those police, sometimes up to 400 at a time, have remained posted across Brussels ever since. They've never really gone away. The numbers fluctuate, but you always see people in camouflage with machine guns on the streets of Brussels. And so those people are very quickly deployed and sometimes often on the scene anyway when it comes to things like the central station. And so without having witnessed it myself, I can be fairly certain that that's why those people were the ones who apprehended the suspects.
So I guess particularly since the terror attacks in Brussels as well on the metro and at the airport in March last year, the soldiers have now just become part of the furniture of the city?
Absolutely. So I did see some more people outside the parliament than normal when I was making my way down here, but people wouldn't think twice in Brussels to see those camouflaged officers. That's just now daily life in Brussels.
Ryan Heath at Politico in Brussels, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Now, the search for a just and lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians has tested, tormented, and ultimately defeated the finest diplomatic minds of several generations. The latest poised to take a lash at it has no obvious qualifications beyond being married to one daughter of the President of the United States. Jared Kushner is due to visit Jerusalem and Ramallah tomorrow as Donald Trump's designated chief negotiator. Concerned that Kushner might share his father-in-law's somewhat lackadaisical approach to preparation, I asked Daniela Peled, managing editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and columnist with Haaretz, for some do's and don'ts. I began by asking about potential pitfalls which might entrap even those not conducting the most delicate of diplomatic negotiations.
Well, Israeli people are quite well known for their being forthright and direct. Some would say brusque, some would say rude. But I imagine Jared Kushner's experience with his father-in-law has probably inured him to experiences like that. People might try a bit too hard to fit in with the sort of local culture. I'm sure he'll wear a yarmulke when he visits the Western Wall. Please, Jared, don't wear a kefir. Stay away from camels when you go to the West Bank. No one thinks it's funny.
And what about things... Are there faux pas or faux pas, I've never figured out which of the two it is, that could be committed either in your interactions with either Israelis or Palestinians? Are there things you shouldn't say?
Well, I think one thing that will offend them both, he should probably stay away from hummus and falafel, because if there's one thing Palestinians or Israelis are sensitive about, it's about whose national dish it is. And there is no answer to this question, and people have come to violence about it.
There's also the ongoing question of which is better.
Hummus or falafel?
No, the Israeli or Palestinian hummus.
I think even the Israelis admit the Palestinian hummus is better.
Well, that's controversial. What should he do if his opinion on which is better is solicited, which it might well be?
Don't mention that it was the Turks that brought it to the region.
Well, aside from those general principles, as he settles down to the work of attempting to negotiate some sort of peace deal, and this is, of course, something which has eluded many, many, some might say, better experienced and, heaven forfend, smarter people. Again, what are some red lines? What should he go in there assuming that neither side actually really wants to negotiate?
Apart from two-state solution and a final end to the conflict.
All of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's off the table. Look, I don't think anyone is taking him seriously. Not the Israelis and not the Palestinians. So no one's hopes are going to be dashed. There aren't any hopes to be dashed. The Israelis are going to prepare some minor concessions to roll out as a little present for him, something to do with boosting the Palestinian economy. I mean, the script has been written many, many times before. And let's see, in Ramallah, maybe he'll be able to tour the grave of Yasser Arafat, which would be a bit of a diplomatic coup for the Palestinians. Beyond that, a few photo ops, a few handshakes, a few conversations with the same old men who have been running this whole game for decades, and that's it. And off he'll go. The best thing I can advise him to redeem the whole visit is to take a leaf out of the book of, you know, many of my journalistic colleagues and play a game that you may have played too, Andrew, called Bibi Bingo. Have you ever done this? Sit through a speech made by Benjamin Netanyahu and take a shot every time he mentions Iran. Take a shot every time he mentions secure borders. Another shot every time he mentions Jewish right, Jewish state, and two shots for the Holocaust.
When you say nobody in the vicinity is taking Jared Kushner seriously, are they taking him noticeably less seriously than they have previous emissaries because of who he happens to be?
Well, I think Secretary of States in the past have punched a little bit.
And actual presidents.
Above their weight. Well, yes, but I'm thinking that would go back quite a long time. But he doesn't really have anything to offer or anything to threaten with. And John Kerry and Hillary Clinton both tried to talk quite tough to the Israelis, for sure, and didn't really come away with anything. There isn't a strategy, there isn't a plan, and there isn't a light at the end of the tunnel for people to strive towards. And the Israelis are not taking the Trump administration massively seriously because also they're so unpredictable. Trump says he supports a two-state solution one day, then he says, well, whatever you guys decide, it's okay with me. You know, there is nothing consistent about this approach, so I don't think the Israelis are thinking that they will make any commitments, and the Palestinians are just waiting and seeing.
To return to the idea of advice for Jared Kushner on the off chance that he might be tuning in as he flies to the Middle East, you say no one's taking him seriously, and there would be every reason why they wouldn't, but is there anything that he could say or could do that might change that? Is there a way that he could surprise them?
Yeah, of course, I think so. If he comes out with some great statesmanlike language, if he gives some sort of rousing speech, if he changes the terms of the debate, if he talks about the occupation and he talks about Palestine and he talks about Jerusalem in new and fresh language. But I'm not sure I've ever heard him speak, ever.
That did change. Well, very few of us had until earlier this week. There was live action footage was captured of Kushner speaking out loud. I think we can say that the stentorian declamations that will ring down the ages might be off the table.
Look, his father-in-law and the whole family were there already. They had an official visit, which is a big deal. Nothing changed. Nothing really happened. So I think expectations are not even low.
If we look at the fundamental that this is supposed to accomplish, a peace between Israel and Palestine, whatever anybody thinks that might look like, his father-in-law, Donald Trump, has said again relatively recently that Israelis and Palestinians are, I quote, ready to reach for peace and make a deal. Are they?
I think they could be with the right incentives and the right threats. If we're talking about the majority of the population of both countries still, I mean, the margins are narrowing, but both still support a two-state solution. There is what to do when it comes to supporting the economy, taking action over violence and incitement on both sides. There are a dozen peace plans that have yet to be tried. And there's also regional will. Well, despite the chaos in the Middle East, I think the Gulf states for sure have made it quite clear that they're willing to make some serious concessions to Israel if it moves on the Palestinian issue. But I think things for real action to happen, I think the political leaderships on both sides have to have something to lose and something to gain. I think the Israelis think wait and see, this holding position is good enough. And the Palestinians have got very little to bargain with at the moment.
Basically, though, you don't sound like you're inclined to bet heavily on Jared Kushner collecting the Nobel Prize for Peace a couple of years hence.
Well, considering what other people have got the Nobel Prize, why not?
That was Daniela Peled from the IWPR and Haaretz speaking to me earlier. You're listening to The Daily.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're You're listening to The Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. Now, relations between the countries which constitute the Balkans are famously volatile. So it seems, on the face of it, cause for nothing but celebration when two of them, which have not previously gotten on terrifically well, locate a common cause, as appears to be the case with Bulgaria's backing of Macedonia's bids to join the EU and NATO. Seasoned Balkans watchers, however, are usually, and usually rightly, reluctant to take such shifts altogether at face value. Well, joining us now to tell us if there's more here than meets the eye is Guy Delaunay, our man in Belgrade. Guy, first of all, a bit of historical context. How badly have Macedonia and Bulgaria gotten on in the past?
We're not talking about white-hot enmity here, Andrew. It's not one of these things which people talk about in the same breath as, say, Serbia, Croatia, Serbia, Albania, those sort of conflicts and enmities that we have in the Western Balkans. And in some ways, actually, Bulgaria and Macedonia have been quite good friends in recent times. Bulgaria, for starters, actually recognises Macedonia by its official name, according to Macedonia, which is the Republic of Macedonia. And it was the first country to recognise Macedonia's independence in 1991. But it's complicated. Bulgarians generally don't recognise Macedonians as a people. They say that they're actually, wait for it, Bulgarians. And this has, of course, made for a poor match with Macedonian nationalism, which has been in the ascendancy for most of the past decade. And it explains incidents like the smashing of a Bulgarian war memorial in Macedonia last year, which, of course, didn't do much for neighbourly relations at all.
So what has changed and why?
Well, we've got a new government in Macedonia. That's the big answer. And this government has come in after 2 years of there being no government. So it's quite a big change, really, in Macedonia, actually having a functioning government for a change. And this government is deciding to take a completely different tack to the one which was in power for the best part of a decade. It's turning away from the nationalism, from all the symbolic nationalism of the former Vumro Depemne government, which was busily throwing up statues and neoclassical buildings like there was no tomorrow, and including appropriating other neighbours' symbols of statehood and pride, which included the Bulgarian Tsar as well as Alexander the Great of Greece. So they were busy doing all of this. This new government, of course, it's trying to do everything quite differently from the last lot. They're turning away from this so-called policy of antiquitisation, and they're trying to make friends with their neighbours, which seems like a sensible course of action.
Well, looking at Macedonia's ambitions of joining NATO, is that a long-held desire on Macedonia's part?
Yes, it is. And it's been the same for several different countries in the region. We've seen Montenegro become the latest member officially just earlier this month, although it was an extremely protracted accession confirmation process. So people have been reporting them joining several times. Macedonia would like to join them. And there's a good reason for them wanting to do this. If you think about Macedonia's place in the region, you know, as I've just mentioned, a lot of Bulgarians think of Macedonians as Bulgarians too. There were historical claims on Macedonia by Bulgaria going back to before the First World War, during the First World War. Have you also got these Greater Albania head the balls as well, who were hanging around as well. So if Macedonia were a member of NATO, it would feel a lot more secure within its own borders.
Bulgaria's Prime Minister Boyko Borisov is going to visit Skopje in August to sign what's being called a friendship treaty. How big a deal is that?
Depends what's in it, Andrew. Bulgaria, yeah. Well, the thing is, Bulgaria's been demanding for a few years special rights and protection for a very, very small Bulgarian minority in Macedonia. And I realise there's a contradiction here, that I've been saying that Bulgarians think of Macedonians as Bulgarians, but they want protection for the Bulgarian minority in Macedonia. Hey, welcome to the Western Balkans. They also want non-interference by Macedonia with what Macedonia views as the Macedonian minority in Bulgaria. So this would be an asymmetric deal. Bulgaria wants protection for its minority in Macedonia, but a promise from Macedonia that it won't interfere with its minority in Bulgaria. That would obviously go down like a cup of something extremely bitter and unpleasant with nationalists in Macedonia. But at the moment, this new government in Macedonia, led by the Social Democrats and Zoran Zaev, the Prime Minister, seems to think it's going to be able to push through these sort of things. And that would then give Macedonia a very strong ally in its quest to join not just NATO, but also the European Union.
You mentioned earlier that Bulgaria, which is, of course, also now now a member of the European Union, had acquiesced, if you will, in referring to Macedonia by its preferred name. And that has, of course, always been a sticking point between Macedonia and Greece. Would it be wildly optimistic at this point to suggest that some sort of rapprochement might be possible between Skopje and Athens? Might the goodwill be extendable?
It's late in the evening. It's a time to get wild, I think, Andrew. We had a meeting last week between the two foreign ministers of Greece and Macedonia, or former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, as they like to call it in Athens. And they actually had a very warm meeting, it would seem. They promised that they would be very nice to each other. Macedonia asked Greece for its help in joining the EU and NATO. Greece said, "We'll be delighted as soon as we can sort out this tricky name thing, but let's meet in a couple of months' time and sort all of this out." So that is progress. Again, it's going to be very difficult to get past Macedonian nationalists, the idea that they would be called anything other than the Republic of Macedonia. We may see a solution whereby Greece calls them by one name and the rest of the world calls them by something else. We've even seen arguments over whether that would be called the Republic of Upper Macedonia or the Upper Republic of Macedonia. seriously, these things count.
We look forward to discussing that further. Guy Delaunay in Belgrade, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. This is The Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Now, 13 years ago or so, European defence ministers inaugurated a plan to maximise the readiness of the EU's militaries to respond to crises abroad, especially the near abroad. Stung, perhaps, by criticism of Europe's failure to act quickly or decisively in the disintegrating Yugoslavia of the 1990s, they initiated a scheme by which small multinational battle groups would be on standby for six-month rotations. 13 years later, however, standing by is all that the battle groups have ever done. I'm joined with more on this by Elizabeth Brough, non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. First of all, Elizabeth, to return to the original big idea, what was it supposed to be able to do that the EU hadn't already been able to do with its militaries?
Well, it was a fantastic idea because there is no such thing as essentially beefed up peacekeeping forces. There are the UN peacekeepers, of course, but they, as the name suggests, guard the peace. And there is nobody else who's on standby to essentially intervene in anything from humanitarian crisis to low-grade conflicts. And so this was the idea. And it would be a nice illustration of European unity, too, that these battle groups, as they are called, would be composed of several EU nations.
So what kind of scenario specifically were they thinking of? Was it things like the civil war in Yugoslavia or similar occurrences perhaps on Europe's borders or even in North Africa?
Well, it was low-intensity conflict. I mean, you wouldn't send a small unit like this to the front line of a conflict like Afghanistan, for example. But imagine the refugee crisis or the in the Mediterranean or the conflict in Mali, which is simmering. It's somewhat violent, but it's not a full-fledged war. Things like that. And then, lo and behold, when it came time to send soldiers to Mali, for example, Germany and France teamed up, forming their own unit. And the battle groups were never taken into account.
So the obvious question then, why haven't these battle groups ever gone anywhere or done anything?
Well, the official answer is that there have been issues about funding. So, as you know, with the UN, countries dispatch troops and were reimbursed by the UN. But the battle groups were supposed to work a little bit differently. And initially, countries would fund their contribution themselves and not be reimbursed. There was a mechanism planned to reimburse them, but that's how it was going to work. So then they could always say, well, the funding doesn't work for us this time. And there were other issues as well. Technical issues. Did they have the equipment, the right equipment and the right composition for a particular conflict? But of course, the real reason was that it would open a can of worms because it would essentially further EU military integration and the spectre of an EU army.
Well, we've talked about that before, and that is, of course, a prospect of which some EU nations are more enthusiastic than others. But so does that mean that the problem was essentially one of chain of command? Who would be commanding who else's soldiers? Because if I've seen that one coming, how did the people behind this scheme not see that one coming?
Well, there was a certain amount of optimism. I mean, you have to remember, even the UK was involved in the initial Indeed. Idea. So it was idealistic thinking, but that hadn't really been considered. And there have been successful occasions of soldiers serving under the command of somebody else. I mean, you just have to think of World War II. But but in practical terms, when push came to shove, it was just too uncomfortable.
So if we look at the period in which these have supposedly been operational, the last decade or so, what kind of scenarios have there been where you would have thought they should have been sent that they haven't? Would you mentioned the refugee crisis? Would going back beyond that, would Libya, for example, have been an obvious deployment for them?
Well, I would argue that it would have been a model deployment, not any sort of mission to topple Gaddafi, but just to create some sense of order in that chaos. And as a result, deal with the refugee crisis or stem the refugee crisis. Also, Mali, where European involvement is clearly welcomed and needed and is there with two nations represented, primarily Germany and France, why could not a European battle group or EU battle group have done that?
Well, the future of these battle groups is supposed to be discussed later this week when EU leaders meet in Brussels. Is anything, well, I guess it, not so much the question is anything likely to change, but what should change?
What should change is that the EU gets a proper military command with a supreme commander who can not deploy the battle groups just on his own, but like any other supreme commander in consultation with political leaders, deploy the battle groups. But the way it works now is that they can only be deployed by consensus of the European EU member states. So that's a whole lot of negotiation involved to just deploy one battle group. Imagine if a supreme commander could consult with Chancellor Merkel or Mr. Tusk and just get it done with.
I very, very hard to imagine the EU ever becoming quite that streamlined. Elizabeth Brough from the Atlantic Council, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, a runoff election for US Congress in Georgia's 6th District would usually struggle for attention anywhere outside Georgia's 6th District. However, the voters of that constituency have gone to the polls today with the eyes of the nation and much of the world upon them, hoping or fearing, depending on inclination, an early rebuke to the presidency of Donald Trump or an endorsement of Donald Trump, whose Republican Party have held the seat for nearly 40 years, and 20 of those by Trump cheerleader Newt Gingrich. The Democrats, however, like their chances sufficiently to have spent millions and millions of dollars trying to win it. Well, I'm joined by Eleanor Schneider, a campaign reporter for Politico, who is in Georgia right now covering the election. Eleanor, I know the polls are still open for another couple of hours, but do we have any idea how this is looking yet?
Well, we've gotten some indication from early vote analysis. So these are people who vote by mail or vote in person early in the weeks leading up to the runoff. And Georgia does not require voters to declare partisanship, which means that it's not totally clear from the data as to whether or not people who are voting are registered Republicans or Democrats. So that's not shared. But based on consumer data and previous participation, people can model for it. And it seems that Ossoff does have a lead, which is what he also had in the primary back in April, and that's to be expected among Democrats. It's just now a question as to whether or not Karen Handel, the Republican, is able to close the gap here on Election Day. And Ossoff built some of a wall, but the question is whether or not it's enough for him to hold on to it.
Now, a lot of the outside world, as I said in the introduction, is looking at this contest between the Democrat John Ossoff and the Republican Karen Handel as essentially a referendum on Donald Trump. You have the advantage of having been able to speak to the people who are actually voting. Do they see it the same way?
They largely do. At the end of the day, it's very hard for people to separate this from Trump's presidency. Democrats often talk about how they feel like they feel guilty about the fact that they didn't do more in the 2016 election, that this for them is a way to send a message to the president. And in contrast, Republicans feel that they don't even care really who the candidate is as long as they send another Republican up there to help with Trump's agenda. So I'd say by and large, that is in fact what voters are talking about, even though the candidates themselves want to avoid and have largely avoided talking about the president as much as possible. Karen Handel, for her part, has really attempted to play it straight down the middle and has tried to keep Trump voters in her base, but not associate with him too much. He came down to the district once, but only did a private fundraiser, did not appear with her publicly. The same with the vice president, Mike Pence. So she's trying to tread very carefully here to not alienate moderate voters, because this district, and part of the reason why Democrats are so invested in it, is that Donald Trump only won it by a point in 2016. So they see this as an opening to put forward a Democrat who, like Ossoff, has tried to play it very straight, very centrist, to appeal to some moderate voters who maybe are unhappy with the direction of the country or unhappy with the president, and may decide to vote for a Democrat.
What's the scale of the Democratic operation on the ground? Have they brought in lots of people? Where are they spending the money?
The scale of the ground game is enormous. I've covered House campaigns for years, and I have never seen anything quite like this before. They have a pretty bottomless pit of money to support them. They talk about how they've had more than 12,000 volunteers here on the ground physically, but they've also got people who are phone banking for them across the country. They've got former Hillary Clinton staffers who have flown down here to help with the closing days. So the ground game, both in this runoff and even in the primary back in April, has been very organized and very robust, because that's what they have to do in order to win in a place like this where it's traditionally Republican.
And how big a media circus do you find yourself part of while you're covering this?
Well, it is surprising when you see people from international news outlets covering a House race. So I'm certainly not the only one. I'm surrounded by national political reporters as well who are coming down here. Part of it's attributable, obviously, to the fact that it's an extremely expensive race that's attracted so much attention. But at the end of the day, too, this is a House race that tells us a little bit something about what might happen in 2018.
Well, what does it tell us exactly? If, say, for example, the Democrat John Ossoff wins and the Republican Karen Handel loses, how big a dent does that put in Donald Trump? Because obviously the baseline we're operating from is that for most of the last 40 years, this has been an absolutely nailed-on Republican district.
So at the end of the day, it is one race and one district. So it doesn't necessarily mean that if Ossoff wins, Democrats are guaranteed to retake the House. But it does give some indication as to whether or not maybe other Republican incumbents who are watching this race, we know for a fact, I've talked to them, people who are congressmen who represent, areas of the Philadelphia suburbs or outside of Los Angeles, are watching this race very carefully, because it may tell them whether or not their own races, how difficult their own races are going to be, and may force some important questions about if they want to, go into such a volatile political environment themselves and have to run an expensive re-election bid. So it's not so much that it necessarily tells us what the results might be in 2018, but it's going to help inform people's decisions, be it incumbents deciding to retire, Democratic candidates deciding that maybe tougher races are worth getting into. It keeps fundraising going for Democrats. And then on the flip side, if Democrats fail to win this after putting in so much money and so much energy into this race, it gives a real boost to Republicans and to Trump to say, look, we were able to hold on to this one, we may be able to hold on to some more. So it's not so much guaranteeing any sort of, it's not a crystal ball, but certainly gives either side a boost.
Well, just to follow that thought up, if Karen Handel does win this, Donald Trump will doubtless claim it as a colossal triumph and a complete vindication of everything he's ever done, said, or thought, and will accrue as much personal credit for it as he possibly can. But will anybody else seriously buy that, especially if it's close? Because like I was saying, it is a rock-solid Republican district. Winning this is basically the least you would expect that a Republican president a few months into his presidency should be able to do.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that is going to be the difficult story for, I mean, that's what Democrats are definitely going to talk about if Ossoff loses this by 1 point. They are going to point to this and still claim victory, arguably, even if Ossoff loses, because this is a place that, you know, Tom Price, the Health and Human Services Secretary who held this seat back in 2016, he won it by more than 20 points. While Trump won it by just one. So this is not a place that Democrats should be able to take. This is a Republican-leaning district. This is an area where at the end of the day, if he gets close, Democrats can still feel good about this. But you know, on the flip side of that, Democrats have been saying sort of these sort of moral victories in a couple of places, in Kansas and in Montana, the two other House special elections that we've had this spring. And in both those places, they've gotten closer. The margins have been tighter, but nonetheless, they have not won. And at a certain point, they've got to start asking themselves the question: Where are we going to start winning?
Elena Schneider with Politico in Georgia's 6th District. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, for the singles of the world who have given up searching for a soulmate the old-fashioned way, i.e. while drunk, tech startups have bequeathed to humanity dating apps. One relatively new app is Bumble, the chief selling point of which is that it empowers women to make the first move. Whitney Wolf is the company's founder. In this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, she spoke with the show's host, Daniel Giacopelli.
It's hard not to think in this day and age, everything's political. I mean, it's 2017, literally everything's political. Mm-hmm. Would you consider your app to be kind of a political statement at all? I mean, it's been called in various articles, you know, it's a feminist app. Is that something that you would go along with?
The truth behind that labeling is really actually an interesting story. When we launched this product, not one person on our team ever said we are a feminist company. Not because we're not proud of that, because it was still this... I'm embarrassed to admit it, but we have to be honest. It was this time where the word was still quite polarizing,
yeah,
and misunderstood, to be honest with you. I did not truly understand what feminism at its core meant until, I think it was Hello Giggles, which I love. Hello Giggles labeled us a feminist dating app. And I kind of said, wait a second. What's going on here? I don't know how to handle this.
There are a lot of men who would be like, oh, I don't want to go on a feminist dating app.
The next day we had hundreds of reviews being like, feminism is stupid. And so it was so funny to see how silly people behave when they hear these words like, you know, political or feminist. And people don't really want to be confronted with that all the time, but we're proud of that. And what we did was we really just said, you know what? We believe in feminism. We believe in those values. Whether we're perfect or if we're 100% feminist, is our product perfect? No, nothing is perfect. It's all a work in progress. But we as a team, we believe in feminist values, so we would love to run with this. Not for a marketing opportunity, but because we believe it's a progressive thing and we want to see that continue to expand. But what I love about this is a lot of these social networking platforms, they've been up against a wall the last couple of years and they're starting to be held accountable, right? Because there's so much conversation taking place
in the startup world.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, look what's happening with Uber right now.
Exactly. And so
I'll name the names, don't worry.
Yeah, thank you. No, the Uber thing is,
I mean, Silicon Valley is kind of right now saturated with stories of kind of, you know, chauvinistic workplace culture.
Listen, misogyny is alive and well. And well, let's correct that. It's alive and unwell. But when I say it's alive and thriving, it's because we have a long way to go. And just because there are companies like Bumble, or just because there are amazing just kind of camaraderie amongst women right now to support one another, it doesn't mean the problem went away. We've got a long way to go. And so I think it's important to hold people accountable. When we have users behave in a chauvinistic or misogynistic way online, we ban them. And we've actually publicly called them out. That being said, we don't want to be this company that is, you know, girl power only, men aren't welcome. We accept and we would love to have men and women be seen as equals. And that's what I love about the audience and the user base on Bumble. We've attracted a man who's proud to, you know, be feminist or to appreciate it and respect women. And I think that's what it's all about. We have to support one another.
What about when you're growing Bumble around the world into various cultures that might not, women might not want to make the first move, or, you know, they might view things differently?
I think this has been the most interesting and taxing part of Bumble so far for me personally.
I mean, it's like what you were saying before, like sociological kind of like.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I can't even tell you, it's fascinating. So we have a team in France and, you know, we were not growing, All of a sudden, we tweaked our messaging ever so slightly. Instead of saying, make the first move, I believe we, and this was in French, so it's translated, I believe we said, you know, the choice is yours. We changed it ever so slightly. Overnight, we saw spikes. The way we are programmed around the world, we all want the same thing. I truly believe at the end of the day, we all have the same human desire, but cultural rules have serious implications on how we think and operate. And it's really unbelievable to see how different, you know, maybe the French culture is versus even American. That being said, we are in Texas, right? So I've had to do this crash course in how do you reprogram a super traditional minded, you know, gender opinion? How do you get the college in Texas, although young women at that school, to buy into Bumble and, you know, own it and be proud of it, because they should, you know, we're helping them. And so
because,
it's been interesting.
Because, I mean, in Texas, like, I mean, it's a more kind of conservative culture, perhaps?
It is. It is.
They like the guys to make the first move?
Yeah. I mean, I remember I went to SMU in Dallas. Yeah, Dallas is, you know, that's just kind of, it's not a, you know, a liberal school up north. It's different mentality. It's not Berkeley, right?
Yeah.
And it was just fascinating to see how you almost have to get real with each other and say, listen, I understand you want him to text you first, but you feel miserable. You feel miserable waiting for this. Why do you keep doing this to yourself? Why do you accept this? This isn't right. This isn't how it should be. And then it clicks, right? And so we're seeing the same thing take place overseas, but you have to be very delicate and you have to really, you know, you have to have training wheels until it really sinks in.
And what have you guys learned about human nature and how we kind of operate as human beings? I mean, you know, you must have so much data. I mean, are we really insecure? Are we really paranoid? Are we really kind of, you know, narcissists? What kind of data have you guys picked up about the way we live?
Well,
I mean, I was talking with Miguel McKelvey, the founder of WeWork last week, and he said, I mean, I asked him the same question. I mean, you must have so much data about how people work, but your company, I mean, it's about how we live and how we are and how
yes.
we, you know, the well, inside of us.
That's exactly right. I mean, we are literally clocking human
swipes left and swipes
behavior,
right.
Behavior, right? And it's not only the swiping, it's actually so much more than that, because you can learn a lot about someone. You get a match. How long does someone wait to message? Why are they doing that? Are they always doing that?
Psychologist's dream.
It's a case study in every which way, right? So what we have learned, when there are rules, we have those in society. You stop at stoplights for the most part, if you're doing it right. And there's consequences. If you drive without a driver's license and you get pulled over, there is a consequence. There is a written consequence that you are held accountable for. Where is that online? It does not exist. And that is really scary.
Yeah, you get the YouTube comment section.
It's really scary. So that being said, with Bumble, we've tried to build in some infrastructure. We've tried to put in a few stoplights and a couple stop signs. And we're trying to encourage user behavior to adapt to that digitally. And so what we have found is when a woman is the one making the first move, the man becomes less aggressive. His reaction is no longer on the defensive, right? You know, the man is always expected to make the first move in real life. So when you tell him to make the first move in real life and you give him a digital profile to hide behind and he reaches out and she doesn't respond, you take that level of insecurity from 0 to 100 really quickly. It can become aggressive. It can become angry and nasty. So when the woman makes the first move, there's almost this inherent flattery that is born within the male response, right? So instead of the man saying, you know, well, whatever nasty word, forget you, I didn't like you to begin with, you're X, Y, and Z, he's actually quite flattered. And he's like, wow, she likes me. And so you've taken his whole life of fear of rejection, his whole life of, you know, go talk to the girl and be mean to her on the playground because that's what you do. You've completely condensed this down into one single moment. And it turns everything on its head. Everything.
That was Whitney Wolfe, founder of Bumble, in conversation with Daniel Giacopelli. You can hear the full edition of The Entrepreneurs tomorrow at 1900 London time on Monocle 24. You can, of course, catch up with that and all our other programs anytime you like on our website at monocle.com/24. Coming up, our review of the Asian newspapers. Do stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Download Meet the Writers and join me, Georgina Godwin, as I introduce you to the man who changed the world with his revolutionary engineering, Thomas Telford. I speak with Julian Glover, former government special advisor on transport and speechwriter for David Cameron, who's just published a best-selling biography of Telford, the man who created the backbone of Britain's national road network, tying England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales together, resulting in his being dubbed the Colossus of Rhodes. That's Julian Glover on Meet the Writers, available now as a podcast.
Time now on The Daily to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We are joined once again by Agatha Kratz, Associate Policy Fellow for the Asia and China Program at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Agatha, to the South China Morning Post first. We started the show tonight by sneering at Jared Kushner's imminent visit to the Middle East. So I guess we can crack on by sneering at Jared Kushner's later visit to Beijing. He and the wife have been invited to visit by the People's Republic.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, it's an unofficial news, but they've apparently been invited to come to Beijing. It's a follow-up on an invitation that was an oral invitation by Xi Jinping himself at the Mar-a-Lago meeting earlier this year. Well, it seems like the two of them have a very busy schedule, not just with China, but with the rest of the world. But this should be a very interesting and visit, and much might come out of it.
Well, indeed. But what is actually going on here? Do we get the impression, and I wonder this about the Middle East as well, whether these people regard Jared Kushner as a substantial and serious person or whether they're just humouring Trump?
No, I don't. Whether they're humouring Trump is one thing, but I think, you know, the whole Trump administration started with Navarro and Bannon on board, and now you've got apparently Ivanka and Jared just taking a bigger role, and that's probably something good for the Chinese. I mean, they don't like, what they dislike the most is not knowing what's going to happen. So if they can speak to people that have a little bit of stability, a little bit of a view, and a little bit of a knowledge of the president, but also kind of a, not a plan, but just kind of stable ideas about how they see the US-China relationship going, I think it's something that the Chinese are looking for.
They're betting on the fact that he can't really lose his temper and fire his own daughter.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, although he could probably, but I think
of tempting fate.
Yeah, they've proven in the past that they're actually much more kind of inclined to speak to the Chinese than other would. If you remember, at Mar-a-Lago, both of their kids had learned very well Mandarin song that they sang in front of the president. I mean, they're culturally aware. They're trying to make an effort, so they're actually very good people to speak to.
Okay, we should move along to a story from Channel News Asia from the Philippines. And this is a new offensive launched by Filipino troops to try and recapture the city of Marawi. This was a story that, I guess, for people who weren't paying attention to the Philippines, kind of reared up a bit. It reminded me a bit of the seizure of Mosul by Islamic State. It's just all of a sudden you realize that this is quite a big deal, because Marawi was not a you know, three street, two goat village. It was a large city, and it has been a very serious fight to get it back.
Yeah, exactly. So the city is considered the Muslim capital in the country, which is a Catholic country mostly. But on March 23, hundreds of militants waving Islamic State flags have rampaged through the village. They've taken Christians hostage. They've torched buildings, etc., etc. So since then, so 5 weeks ago, the Filipino army has been trying to get the city back. It's been a very complex fight because there's a lot of civilians still on the ground, and they've actually, the Filipino army has actually been relying on a lot of US support for that.
But this story makes it clear, you know, planes flew overhead dropping bombs, automatic gunfire sustained with occasional blasts from artillery. President Rodrigo Duterte is making a large-scale macho point of how he's going to win this, but he makes a large-scale macho point of absolutely everything. He arrived in power as an uncompromising authoritarian. Does it actually undermine him, the fact that on his watch a reasonably big city in the Philippines can be overrun by terrorists?
No, I don't think so, because I think, as you said, it was a pretty big surprise what happened. There had been signs of Islamic militant being in the country for a little while. I think if anything, the fact that the city is being bombed very heavily is just a characterization of Duterte being someone that doesn't like nuance much. So he's just going full on.
Staying with Channel News Asia, this is a story, an update on the story of that poor kid, Otto Wambia, the American who died very shortly after returning from North Korea. Donald Trump calling it a total disgrace, unsurprisingly. Is this one death, though, ghastly though it is, going to have a material impact on relations between Washington and Pyongyang? They're about as bad as they could possibly be anyway, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's one more blow to a very, very bad relation. The one reason why I picked this article is not so much Trump's reaction, which was strong, but it's, normal given what happened, but it's Korean President Moon's reaction that I thought was very interesting, because Moon is supposed to be someone that embraces or favors engagement with North Korea, but he did say following this event that he now can envision a worsened scenario if engagement doesn't work, where he and Trump might someday start talking about launching a preemptive strike, which is something that you wouldn't expect from Moon, and this is the one reason I picked this article.
Well, indeed not. I mean, it is an interesting quote from President Moon when he says, "I believe we must now have the perception that North Korea is an irrational regime." And that's quite significant, isn't it? Because the common wisdom has always been that the regime may be all sorts of other terrible things, but by their own lights, they are rational and therefore predictable and would not do anything to precipitate their own destruction. But is President Moon suggesting that we may have to rethink that?
I think this one comment is mostly to try and explain why this terrible even happened. And it is true that it is a very irrational regime, and it's a very irrational regime that can lead to this kind of situation happening despite tensions being so high between Pyongyang and Washington.
I mean, you can get vastly confused very quickly trying to understand what Donald Trump actually means when he tweets anything, but about 3 hours ago he did tweet, "While I greatly appreciate the efforts of President Xi in China to help with North Korea, it has not worked out. At least I know China tried."
It doesn't mean much, but it is actually, it's a very important event in the China-US relationship, though, because in 2 days, very high-ranking Chinese and US officials are going to meet for the first diplomatic and security dialogue that was created at Mar-a-Lago. So it's the format of US-China relations since Trump took office. And this is probably going to rank very high on the agenda.
I did want to look finally and very briefly at a story from the Straits Times, because this startled me, I have to say. This is a survey of Hong Kong youth, admittedly only 120, so I'm not sure how representative it is. But nonetheless, only 3.1% of them identify themselves as Chinese or even broadly Chinese. That is an astoundingly low number.
It's very, very low. It's especially low because when the poll... So it's done every half year. And in 97, it was conducted for the first time. And 31% of the people said they were feeling broadly Chinese or quite Chinese. So it's 10 times less in terms of proportion. And it's very, very low. And it shows how disappointed, or at least disheartened, Hong Kongers are with the return to China. And certainly the fact that efforts to integrate Hong Kong into the mainland have somehow failed.
But it suggests the sort of the rising, especially among young people, of an entirely separate national identity as Hong Kongers. That's not going to thrill anybody in Beijing, is it?
No, especially if they take the street as they did in the past few years. I mean, that's gonna be a big concern for Chinese officials.
Agatha Kratz from the ECFR, thank you as always for joining us. You are listening to The Daily. Now, this Friday marks the opening of the new pavilion at the Serpentine Gallery in London. Every year, an international architect brings a temporary installation to the city. This time, it's Diabedo Francis Kere, the award-winning architect from Gando in Burkina Faso. His pavilion was inspired by a tree that used to serve as a central meeting point in Gando. The expansive roof, supported by a central steel pillar, imitates a tree's canopy. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco went to the press preview and spoke with the architect.
The inspiration for this pavilion is the figure of the tree in the landscape. So of course I didn't want to build this tree here. It is about the idea, and then the tree as a gathering space. You know, in Burkina Faso it is very hot and very dry for part of the year, and with a very intense rainy season. What I wanted to create in summer in London at Kensington Park is to create a big gathering space. If it's hot in Burkina, people migrate, gravitated naturally towards shaded and cool places. And I wanted to do this in here as the 2017 Serpentine Pavilion.
You're talking about rainy season. Well, in London it does rain a lot, so I think this might become useful at times. Which sort of material did you use for the pavilion? I have to say, it looks kind of very open, very airy in some ways.
Yes, exactly. I wanted, you know, like having the chance to do something in London, I tell myself it is one of the most advanced places regarding engineering and handcraft and technology. What can I do? I wanted to use a traditional material, wood, which is a natural material. Trees can be growing, so you will get it. But it is a traditional material that I wanted to use in a very, very different way, in a very refreshing and surprising way. That way I use wood, it is wood, but it is stained with a blue, indigo blue, so to just make a surprise, but to protect the wood against weathering. That's what I wanted to do here.
Francis, tell us a bit more, you know, I know you were born in Burkina Faso, but tell us where are you based and which sort of projects are you usually involved?
Yeah. I was born in Burkina Faso, in West Africa, in a little village. And so I got the scholarship to go to Germany and to study. And so I studied architecture and starting to build in my home village. I started as a student to build a school to create an access for many other kids to education. And so my career was started without knowing yet that it will bring me toward London. I am still working a lot in Burkina Faso, in many other places in Africa, but as in the Western world, economically seen, in Europe, in America, and then some ideas coming from China too.
Finally, being from Burkina Faso, do you feel that you have to represent your country kind of everywhere you go? You know, I'm from Brazil, I feel the same way as well, because you're kind of an ambassador for your country.
Yeah. No, somehow, coming from a given country, you are always a representative for that culture, for that country. I was happy enough to go to school and to learn, to attend education, and then to become an architect and to bridge, you know, bridge the Western world with my home country. So it creates something new, something modern, made out of my profession. So that is it.
And that was Diabeto Francis Carré speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Carré's Serpentine Pavilion in Hyde Park here in London will be open to the public until October 8th. And that is all for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Jolene Goffin and Hanzadeh Achakalan. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. I'm Andrew Mullop. Thanks for listening.